degrees in Racine and Kenosha, 43 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We were talking theater yesterday, a madcap comedy that has opened at the Racine Theater Guild called Drop Dead. There are some interesting connections, and yet I think the play we're going to be talking about today could probably not be more different than Drop Dead, although the theme of death is woven into its fabric a bit. We're going to be talking today about a brand new play, which is about to receive its world premiere at Carthage as part of Carthage's groundbreaking new play initiative. It is a play called Memento Mori, which is a well-known Latin phrase that's been around for centuries that essentially means remember that you must die. And this is a play that helps participants and those watching the play to grapple with some profound questions about the nature of human life, why we exist in the first place, what happens afterwards, what is the next step, and what matters most. A profound and deeply moving examination of what it means to be mortal and coming to terms with that. I'm so happy to have with me on the phone Dr. Neil Sharnick, who is Associate Professor of Theater at Carthage and also coordinator of the New Play Initiative. And he will be telling us about the exceptionally collaborative nature of this new play, that is, how it has come into being and what audiences can expect if they come to performances this weekend or the following of Memento Mori at Carthage College. Professor Neil Sharnick, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here, Greg. Thank you.
Ahead of us talking specifically about Memento Mori, I think it would be very helpful and interesting for our listeners to hear a bit more about the New Play Initiative, which I think has been around since 2009. Tell us what you can about how this was put together. I know that you were certainly part of the Carthage Theater faculty at that point in time and probably have vivid memories of this undertaking in its early going.
Yeah, I do. Going back to, just before 2009, a couple of years before, the theater department was starting to see some growth for the first time in a while, and Professor Herschel Kruger had recently come in as the chair. I was there. Professor Martin McClendon had joined at the time as the technical director. Professor Kim Instant is really an extraordinary costumer, joined the team. So the student numbers were growing, the faculty was sort of stabilizing, and the curriculum had been rewritten, and the season itself was growing more ambitious. We were doing more work, and because of that additional work we were doing, it was essential to bring in more guest artists to see that through. That for a couple of years, that was bringing in guest directors, some guest designers. But in 2009, we had an exciting opportunity to bring in a guest playwright. At that time, it was Eric Simonson, who's a member of the Steppenwolf Ensemble. He is a Tony-nominated director, an Academy Award-winning filmmaker. So he, through some connections, we were able to get Eric Simonson in to write a play for us. And it was just such an extraordinary experience, our students getting to work hand in hand closely with such an accomplished playwright and theater maker that we quickly realized that was something really profound and special, and an opportunity we wanted all our students to have. So we got to work on charting a course where every year we would be developing a new play, that our students would have that opportunity to work with these professionals, to rise to their standard of professionalism and performance and artistry and creativity. And obviously every experience has been vastly different one to the other, the level of engagement, the type of engagement that the playwrights have wanted. This is our 14th year, this play, Memento Mori. And we already have a course charted through the next couple of years. So we're excited to see that continue and be really one of our real marks of distinction and distinctiveness for the Carthage Theater program.
That's great. It sounds like this initiative actually began not necessarily as an initiative. I mean, you brought in Eric Simonson, he created this new play, and then you realized, oh my gosh, we need to keep doing this. Let's create the new play initiative. And so Eric Simonson's play, in a sense, was inadvertently the start of something big that's still with us to this day.
That's exactly right. At the time, I was working on my PhD in Madison, and my dissertation advisor, Aparna Darwadkar, I took a seminar. This sounds like a total non sequitur, but it will connect in a moment. I took a seminar on modern Indian theater with her, and a play that really moved me and I found very exciting was by a man named Mohan Rakesh, and it's a modern Hindi classic called, in translation, One Day in the Season of Rain. And while we were just starting things going with Eric Simonson and realizing how exciting this opportunity was, I had a conversation with Aparna, where she mentioned being friends with Anita Rakesh, the widow of Mohan Rakesh, and that she had been asked to do the authorized English translation of that play, but with her own research and everything else, she'd just been very busy. So I, knowing what was going on with Eric Simonson, said, well, what if a college wanted to produce it and commission it? She said, oh, well, I'd do it in a heartbeat. I'm very excited to do it. I just haven't had the time. So we reached out to her, and that quickly became the second play in the initiative. And so we got to do the world premiere of this new translation of a modern Hindi classic. And then that really, the ball was really rolling then. We were able to keep moving.
And it has been so exciting over the years. What goes into kind of the planning of the next year and the year after that? And you indicated earlier that already there are at least the framework of a plan for the next couple of seasons. But is it just enough that there's this great playwright, he's willing to write you a play? Which sounds like a relatively simple matter. I mean, not the writing of the play being simple, but I mean, is it as simple as just handing an opportunity to somebody deemed worthy? Or are there other things that have to be kind of considered as well in terms of making sure it's the right play at the right time?
Well, there are a lot of things that are considered, but one of the things that's really exciting and extraordinary about it is, you know, we lament at times, you know, we don't have, we're looking for plays with that are really written for college-age actors that would be perfect for our students, where nobody in the cast has to play grandma, right? There were nobody, because all our actors really are 18 to 22, with very few exceptions. So to find a play that's appropriate for them is tricky. So when you're working with a playwright, you already are at an advantage because you know you're starting from the beginning and can say this is the makeup of our department. We have more women than men. We have actors who are of a certain age. We have, you know, so in some ways it's the end product almost necessarily will be more perfect, better suited for the community that we have, the students that we have, than if we just scoured the earth for the perfect play. You know, in some ways, the only way to get the perfect play is to make it. Now, the question of who that playwright is, every example, it's sort of a different story of how of how that came to be. You know, whether it's Arlene Hutton, whose Patience and Fortitude we premiered a year ago. Well, that was just a matter of that being of me knowing that she another college, another university that she'd worked with, and her being a playwright I'd admired for years for her play Last Train to Nibrok and that series of plays. So I knew a professor at a university that had worked with her in another context. So there's just sort of a different story for every one of those initiatives. In 2013, maybe the project that's most like this one, in 2013, I had reached out to the Gaiety School of Acting in Dublin, and Patrick Sutton, who's the director there, I knew also that they had partnered with some other colleges and universities to develop new work. In fact, Marquette University up the street, I knew that they had worked with the Gaiety School once, and I attended there briefly as a student. I had a few connections, so I reached out to them, and we developed this play with them, with playwright Martin McGuire, an Irish playwright, developed a new play, A Clamor of Rooks, that we then took to Dublin and performed at Smock Alley Theatre. And it was the first time, it was another first for Carthage Theatre, taking a play overseas, and which is something we've now done five or six times since, and that was just 2013. Hmm. That's really how Memento Mori started, was after that exciting project, wanting to do it again. So I reached out to the Gaiety School and wanted to work specifically with educator and actor and theater maker Donald Courtney, and the reason I was targeting and interested in Donald Courtney was because he taught a class at the Gaiety School, which is the National Theater School of Ireland, a class called Manifesto. And this is a theater program that all their students enroll in, that's about students creating work or actors creating work that's meaningful to them, right? So it's turning actors into playwrights or theater makers or devisers, not just being trained to go audition for work, but to understand your own creative voice, to tell the story, to create the theater piece that's going to be meaningful to you. So I reached out and began talking to Donald about how we might incorporate some of what Manifesto is into the new play that we develop. Now, Manifesto most often creates small, usually one actor, one man shows, right, where you're creating something of your own, you know, and finding your own artistic voice. So began talking with Donald about how do we make a play for 11 people that's meaningful to all of them in the kind of way that Manifesto is supposed to be. And I said, well, we need to find a theme that's universally meaningful, right? I mean, we need to ask a question. We need to give a prompt that will engage everybody on that level. And I don't remember if it was him or me who said, well, mortality, right? The fact that we're all going to die someday, the fact of the questions that surround grief and loss, that surround what happens when we die, what does that do to the meaning of our existence, you know? So we very quickly latched onto that idea and started through Zoom for Donald workshopping and developing some ideas. Now, things took a turn when the plan was Donald last spring was going to visit Carthage and work with us. First, Donald took a new job. He's wasn't at the Gaiety School anymore. He was asked by a former student of his, actor Michael Fassbender, some of your listeners may know. They're both from Killarney, and Michael Fassbender was starting a theater school in Killarney, West End House School of Arts, and asked Donald to be the founding director of that school. So the project shifted from the Gaiety School to the West End House, but we continued to move forward. And but then prior to his coming in the spring, he reached out to me and let me know that he would not be the person coming in the spring because he would be under treatment for cancer. Mm. And But he was very optimistic and determined, and we pressed on, and Charlie Hughes, a colleague of his, came out, and the workshop was great. But then by summer, I got word from Charlie that Donald had passed away.
Wow.
And as we continued to develop work around the question, the theme, the reminder, the prompt, remember that you must die, here we lose one of the engines of the project and the inspirations of it. And it really... really drove it home.
Yeah, changed it all, changed everything. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Neil Sharnick, Associate Professor of Theater at Carthage College and the director of the latest play in the New Play Initiative, a play called Memento Mori, Latin for Remember That You Must Die, a brand new play that opens this weekend. So tell us a little bit about this workshopping process, much of which occurred, it sounds like, over Zoom. What were the kind of the nuts and bolts by which the play actually took place? What was that process like?
Yeah, some of it went as planned, some of it very much didn't, but the way that the manifesto class worked, which was what we really were tapping into to begin with, is it's really just week by week, class by class, there is a prompt given to the students, something fairly nebulous. It might be, you know, just a statement, a question. It might be it could be a song. It could really be anything. And then I just have all the students, you know, create a short piece. It can literally be 30 seconds. It can be whatever. But we tend to lean into image, right? Try to create something visual, you know, using the language of theater, not just, not just words. But sometimes it means coming in and performing a monologue or a piece inspired by it. Ask, you know, so the prompt could be a question about your own life and your own experience with, because of the nature of this play, with loss, with grief, with whatever, your own speculations about life after death, your own, you know, just bring that into the room. And what it ended up being, because so much of the work ended up having to happen over the summer, was putting out prompts and getting the students to write. Sometimes they'd write little scripts, sometimes they just, you know, put some text on a Google Doc and share it and you know, to read and look at and respond to each other's work. And while it wasn't exactly how it had initially been envisioned, because I had Donald as a collaborator when we set out, what it became was that I was co-playwright and editor, trying to imagine how all of these pieces might come together to inform and shape a full-length play. Now, when we collaborated with the Gaiety School before, there was a playwright, Martin McGuire, on the team, so that in that instance, Patrick Sutton came, did a workshop with our actors over spring break, and took a lot of pictures, took, you know, 2,000 pictures and hours of video, and brought all of that back with him and shared it all with the playwright, who then sort of soaked in it for a while and then wrote a play based on our images, on those images, on those ideas, but really just sort of using those as a springboard into what he was going to write. Here, I think it's much more personal, much closer to, you know, the students really, there are words in this play written by every member of the cast, right? There are experiences shared that are really directly connected to each of them, and I think some really profound ways. So while it became my job to be editor and to have some vision for the larger shape and scope of the play, they were all pretty directly collaborating. And again, this play was cast almost exactly a year ago without any script, right? So we found actors that we could work with who had an interesting creative voice and who were willing and able and interested in seeing this thing through to its completion. And you know, when we open in this week, it's not done, right? As we will be taking this play in January back to Ireland. So so that's a large commitment for one of our students to take on, and to have 11, actually 18, if you include the crew members who are part of the project as well. It's really an exciting and ambitious undertaking for these students that I think they'll carry with them forever.
So, first of all, can we talk about a final product? I mean, as in, ultimately, is there a script for Memento Mori? I mean, have you created something that would resemble a script with words on the page that are at least to some extent finalized? Or is this, by its very nature, something that is a bit more free-flowing and a little less fixed than we think of the typical play?
No, ultimately what we achieved is pretty much a script, right? It's unconventional in some ways, but not in ways that are untheatrical. I mean, from the beginning, Donald Courtney was part of a international tour of Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, along with Charlie Hughes, the actor who came in and ended up doing the workshop with us. So Samuel Beckett is present in the plays. And for those who know Beckett's plays, you know that there's, first of all, that they are profoundly existential to begin with, which is appropriate for what we're doing, but also the pace, the silences that permeate, right? There's things about the plays that were radical and unconventional in the time. Now, he's been a very inspirational playwright, maybe the most important of the 20th century. But he and another playwright, a Belgian symbolist playwright named Maurice Maeterlinck, who had some very specific and unusual notions of the spirit world and life after death, and used the stage to communicate those ideas. Those two playwrights, for me, ended up sort of serving as the inspiration for how this story can come together and what it can look and sound like on stage. And ultimately, yeah, the actors have characters. There is a story that is being told. It is a script.
What has it been like for these young people to be grappling with these kind of questions? Not that the typical college student of typical college student age hasn't thought about these questions already and maybe experienced their reality in the sense of losing somebody precious, but what are we talking about in terms of grappling with these questions on this kind of level?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, and something that I was mindful of, that as sort of editor and compiler and ultimately author of responsible for the script, the students come in with a perspective, not that there's anything monolithic about their perspective, but they are all of roughly the same age, with sort of the same amount of experience, and you know, late teens, early 20s, there's a sense of invincibility, right? And there's a sense, it's easy to imagine your immortality at that age. So it was important to me that I not filter it too much into my words and thoughts and experiences. Also that, you know, they come from different faith traditions, they come from different philosophical, you know, understandings of the world. So figuring out a way to tell this story in a way that's cohesive, that makes sense, but also honors all the different perspectives and honors where they're at. What ended up happening is the play is set after a funeral. A friend of the group named Alice has recently and suddenly and unexpectedly died, and these people are grappling with that. So that creates an opportunity for individual characters to have these different perspectives, these different experiences, these ideas, and bring them into this conversation. We find them right after the funeral, feeling dissatisfied with it, feeling like they, whatever funerals are supposed to do for us, like it didn't take, right? They're unsettled and they find their way sort of into a back room at the church and just sort of to get away. But then several of them do this, and then the conversation continues. So that's sort of what half of the play is them talking through their grief and their understanding of life and death. But at the same time, these scenes are interspersed with other scenes where we see the other side of the veil, to talk like one, a symbolist playwright. We see Alice, and we see her experience after death as well. So while some of the collaborators, some of the actors really leaned into telling their own stories of grief and loss, asking those questions, others, you know, maybe decided they wanted to do something more abstract or poetic or speculating about the soul, about life after death. What this play and its shape does is it allowed for all of that to happen, right? We can have the grounded, realistic conversation about grief and loss while also showing something more magical and theatrical and speculative.
Hmm. Sounds remarkable. And it also sounds like the kind of project that is not for the faint of heart, in the sense that I'm so impressed with the notion of taking all of these individual efforts and somehow drawing them all together into something that would be cohesive. I mean, that just sounds like maybe the hardest way to create a play, and tremendously satisfying, I'm sure, if and when it all comes together.
Yeah, I appreciate that, because it has unquestionably been the most demanding experience of my career to serve as director of this. And, you know, the reality is, even just serving as director on this play rather than a production of Neil Simon's Rumours, you know, your job, yes, you do all the things that a director does, but also, you know, shortly before the school year started back up, one of our actors unexpectedly lost her father. And that's something that as a teacher, as a director, as a human being, right, you all already is something you have to figure out how you're going to handle that and be thoughtful and help that person in the ways that are far more profound and important than directing them, right? And, you know, but with this play, that happens, and it's constantly present. And we had another cast member have their mother had a health crisis while working through the show, and just figuring out how to navigate this show into safe harbor while life doesn't give us a safe harbor, right? Figuring out how to shepherd this thing along has been emotionally as well. I mean, beyond the normal time consumingness, not a word, of directing and writing and everything else, just finding myself in that role where I need and want to give support. But I think even in those instances, some, you know, that this rehearsal room, this cast can become a place and a space for working through grief. It can be too much, and just trying to figure out student by student. Had another student yesterday before rehearsal come and just tell me that a couple friends from high school had died that day in a car crash, and it just keep, I guess this must happen all the time and in every semester, but But it just has felt this semester, maybe because it is so completely the focus of what we're doing, it feels like we are surrounded by reminders, by mementos mori, right? By reminders that our time here is short. And the question that follows of what we're going to do with it.
Right. So when are the performances of Memento Mori, and what do people do if they want to come experience what sounds like a really amazing bit of theater?
Yeah, and I do want to quickly state, it's not all bleak, right? As anyone who's been to a funeral, or as anyone who's speculated with hope or dread about death and life after, it's a mixed bag. And so I do want your listeners to know, well, I don't want to just go cry and grieve for an hour and a half. To answer your question, we open November 4th and perform the 4th and 5th at 7:30 and the 6th at 3 p.m. Then again, November 10th through 12th at 7:30. So 2 weekends.
Very good. Well, as someone who's created a couple of small operas for our opera students, I can speak from experience to what a powerful experience it is for students to be at the leading edge of sharing something with the world that nobody has ever done before. I mean, that in and of itself is a pretty powerful experience, even when it's a fairly modest undertaking in scope, let alone when something like Memento Mori is created, which touches on so many profound issues of the human experience. I just can't imagine anything more powerful or important. And I hope everybody listening to this conversation will think very seriously about taking in one of these upcoming performances this weekend or the next of Memento Mori, created by students of Carthage College in collaboration with West End School of the Arts, and directing this production, Neil Sharnick. Neil Sharnick, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I am excited to see Memento Mori. I'm sure many others are as well. And thank you for being on The Morning Show today. Best wishes to you and to your cast and crew.
Thank you very much, Greg.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from The Morning Show archives. We talk today about fear, but more important even than talking about fear, we will talk about some ways in which you can confront any fear issues which you might have in your life. And a lot of people have fear issues. In fact, some statistics suggest fully one quarter of all Americans have or will have what we would call an anxiety disorder. And as our guest, Dr. David Tolan, is going to explain, this makes it a problem which actually dwarfs things such as depression or substance abuse. I mean, there are so many of us walking around with these issues, and in many cases with issues so severe that our lives are adversely affected and the lives of those around us, those we care about and who care about us. Dr. David Tolan is a well-known psychologist, psychiatrist, and director and founder of the Institute of Living, and specifically at the Anxiety Disorders Center. And some of his colleagues there have collaborated with him in his most recent book, which is called Face Your Fears, A Proven Plan to Beat Anxiety, Panic, Phobias, and Obsessions, a book published by John Wiley and Sons. Dr. Tolan is taking aim at a very important and complex topic, and trying to help us come to terms with the role that excessive fear might have in our lives. And I'm very excited to have this opportunity to speak with him. And by the way, the name Dr. David Tolan may be familiar to you from some different television programs he has been associated with, such as the OCD Project and the A&E series Hoarders. And he's been on a lot of other programs as well, sharing his expertise. Dr. David Tolan, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Greg. Nice to be with you.
Look forward to this very much. I was really staggered by the statistic quoted in your book, that one that I mentioned about a quarter of Americans having or at some point in their lives having an anxiety disorder. I wonder if you could just say a word about how much this is a peculiarly American phenomenon.
I wish I could say that it was, but it actually turns out that this is a worldwide phenomenon, and this has been detected, by the World Health Organization, who, lists, their leading causes of illness-related disability. And time again, anxiety disorders rank right up there near the top. This really is the most common mental...
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
What appears to be very sophisticated scientific fashion, and you actually lay out your book acknowledging those categorizations, but actually choosing to talk about this in your own terms, in categories which you describe as, in a sense, simpler and maybe kind of more intuitive. Talk a moment about your concerns about the way we frame our discussions and understandings of fear and what you've done in this book instead.
Sure. Well, we get the names for these disorders from a volume that comes out every few years that's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM. It's published by the American Psychiatric Association. And in the anxiety disorders, it lists a number of diagnoses. And these might be things that people have heard of before. They're things like panic disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, phobias. And those labels are fine, but if you are trying to do something about the problem, they don't necessarily lend themselves very well to kind of intuitively understanding what it is that you need to do. So I thought, really what makes much more sense is to break fear down into what the person is afraid of and why. And what we see is that those categories are much fewer in number, and they overlap across various things that are within the anxiety disorders, as well as in some things that are not listed in the anxiety disorders, but I think perhaps should be.
I love the fact that your book actually opens with a brief little anecdote about yourself, mm-hmm. something to the effect that as you were penning those particular words, you happened to be on an airplane mm-hmm. and freely acknowledge a bit of anxiety of your own in that moment. I don't remember if you were in takeoff or landing or in mid-flight, but I wonder if you could just say a word about your real-life experiences with fear.
Sure. Well, it was kind of fortuitous because I was having writer's block. I knew the book that I wanted to write, and I was on an airplane at the time, and I had my laptop open, and I was sitting here racking my brain thinking, I know what I want to write, but I don't know how to start the book. What do I write? And then all of a sudden the captain comes on and says, we're about to experience severe turbulence, buckle up. And the plane started pitching, and I paid attention to what I was thinking and feeling and doing on that flight, and then thought, I think I know how I'm going to start the book. And I just started by describing what was happening to me on this flight. Now, I'm not a phobic of flights, but I was experiencing fear, which is a universal human emotion. It's my guess is that most of the people on the plane were experiencing that to some degree. But I broke it down into talking about, what does that mean biologically? What happens to the body when somebody experiences fear? And I talked about what happens mentally when somebody is experiencing fear. What kinds of things do they think about, and how do they think and process information? And then I talked about it behaviorally. So what does somebody do when they feel anxious as a way of trying to feel better, and does that work, or does that contribute to the problem? And it turns out that actually the very kinds of experiences I was having there on that airplane in turbulence are precisely the same things that we talk to our anxiety disordered patients and clients about. We talk to them about what those bodily sensations mean and the role of your thinking and your own actions in causing the fear to persist.
I wonder, as you put this book together, what sorts of pitfalls you wanted to avoid, because you acknowledge the fact that mountains of books about fear have been written, some of which you find to be well-written books and
sure,
worthwhile books, and which you, I think, acknowledge even more specifically. But there's also been a lot of poor and not particularly helpful stuff written about fear.
Right.
What were you most anxious to avoid as you put this book together?
I was trying to strike a balance here. And as you mentioned, Greg, there are a lot of really very well-written self-help books about how to deal with anxieties and fears and anxiety disorders. And I'm a big fan of them, and I even recommend them by name in the book. However, the problem with those is generally that they are too narrow. That is, they only are written to apply to one very specific DSM anxiety disorder. And they don't tell you what to do about other forms of anxiety. And the problem is, of course, most people with anxiety disorders actually have multiple kinds of anxiety. They have multiple fears. So unless you want to buy an entire shelf worth of books, it's very hard to find one comprehensive guide that sort of tells you how to do it. Now, the other books that are out there that are broadly written, that is, they're written to help people with anxiety disorder, many of them are chock full of misinformation and actually could steer readers down the wrong path into things that I think are frankly unhelpful, at the very least don't have any scientific support behind them, or in some cases may even be harmful or dangerous.
Speaking of that, your book includes a questionnaire in which the reader is invited to answer a number of different questions about themselves and the sorts of things which set off their own fears. And it helps a reader to potentially place themselves within the framework of the different types of fear that you address.
Mm-hmm.
But what I especially appreciate about your questionnaire are sort of the points of clarification which follow it, because it underscores the fact that any kind of a questionnaire, no matter how carefully you put it together, is still a relatively blunt and not all that sophisticated sort of instrument,
mm-hmm,
that so easily can be misused. I mean, that, for instance, somebody can end up convincing themselves that they have a terribly serious disorder, or
mm-hmm,
or in other ways, I mean, act on the questionnaire and its results in an inappropriate way. I so
yeah,
appreciate the fact that you have, in a sense, some disclaimers and some points of clarification that really will help the reader, I think, to use this questionnaire properly.
Yeah, and one of the things that I'm really steering away from, and I think it's in the spirit of the whole program, is I'm steering away from trying to diagnose people. It doesn't mean there's no place for diagnosis in the business, but in this context, you know, I didn't want people to come up with, you know, read the questionnaire and come away thinking, aha, this questionnaire tells me I have OCD, because that's not really an appropriate role for a self-administered questionnaire. If you really want to be diagnosed and know what the DSM label for your condition is, you have to go and talk to a specialist. However, if the issue is that you're experiencing fear, then all we need to do is start to understand what kind of fear that is. And so that's really what the questionnaire is aiming to do. And from there, we break it down, and people can categorize themselves into one or more of several categories of fear. These are not diagnoses. These are just descriptive statements about what are you afraid of. And some people are afraid of specific situations or objects or activities. Now, this could be things like, you know, snakes, spiders, high places, elevators, and so on. Some people are afraid of body sensations, That is, they're afraid of physiological sensations that come from inside their body, which they then believe to mean something, you know, is very medically wrong, or that they're going to have a disastrous attack of some kind. And some people have social and performance fears. That is, they're primarily afraid of having to interact or perform in front of other people, and they're afraid that they're going to be humiliated or embarrassed. And there are some people who have excessive worrying. That is, they tell themselves nightmare scenarios about bad things that could happen in the future. And finally, there are some people who have what we might call post-traumatic fears. That is, they develop fears because something awful happened to them, and part of what they start to become afraid of are the memories of the event itself. And by simply using that framework, it helps lead the reader to what I think is a much more intuitive plan for, well, if I can categorize my fear this way, then I can develop a step-by-step plan to show me exactly what I need to do about it.
We're speaking with Dr. David Tolan and talking about his book, Face Your Fears, A Proven Plan to Beat Anxiety, Panic, Phobias, and Obsessions. The bedrock of what you write about in your book is exposure therapy, which is a means by which, in careful fashion, someone ultimately is exposed to that to which they are so fearful, in a careful process of sort of realizing life doesn't end, the ceiling doesn't crash in, just because you hold that piece of soap or whatever it is that is causing you such anxiety. Mm-hmm. You tell us that exposure therapy is woefully underutilized in clinical practice.
Yeah.
Why would that be?
Well, I think that there's several reasons for it, and one of which is that it is still not nearly as widely taught to mental health practitioners as would be reasonable. You know, we are still, I think that what we're seeing is kind of the dawning of a new age in mental health care, one that is much more carefully and rigorously based on the science of human emotion and cognition and behavior. I think what we end up with is for a lot of mental health practitioners, what is being taught and used is not terribly scientifically valid, and what is scientifically valid tends not to be taught and used. You know, and so what you find actually is that when you go to a mental health professional, and that could be a psychologist, it could be a psychiatrist, a social worker, a licensed professional counselor. If you have an anxiety disorder, the two most likely things you are likely to get are talking therapy and medications. Those are the most commonly used treatments. And the fact of the matter is that the medications are okay, but probably not great. The talking therapy really hasn't been shown to help all that much with anxiety disorders. It may feel good to go and talk to a counselor, but in terms of actually making the anxiety disorder get better, it doesn't seem to do that. There are actually some things you need to do in order to overcome a fear, and those principles are rooted in exposure therapy. You have to disrupt the cycle of avoidance and start to confront successfully the things that you're afraid of.
Hmm. As is your book, Face Your Fears, A Proven Plan to Beat Anxiety, Panic, Phobias, and Obsessions, published by John Wiley and Sons. Dr. David Tolan, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you for writing this book. I can see how it would be tremendously helpful to many, many people. I'm glad we could discuss it today on The Morning Show.
Well, thank you very much, Greg.
And the time is 8:58 here on WGTD. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear the conversation which I have recorded with Molly Fletcher, who is someone who was one of the first women to break into the top echelon of sports agents, and has gone on to be an author, a motivational speaker, and also the host of a really terrific podcast called Game Changers with Molly Fletcher. And you're going to be hearing from her tomorrow on The Morning Show. She's actually coming to the campus of Carthage College as a special guest of the Sports Speaker Series. She's going to be speaking on Monday, November 7th, 12 noon, in the Todd Weir Center, talking about the world of professional athletics. And so you can hear my conversation with her tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org.